Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. I'll be talking today with the Peninsula Symphony's music director, Mitchell Klein, about the orchestra's concert this weekend, which features pianist Conrad Tau and composer Carolyn Bremer, who will also join me in studio. Plus, from the Golden Gate Symphony and Chorus, music director Urs Lionheart Steiner is joined by Chinese soprano E. Triplett to talk about their concert collaboration. You'll also hear from Barbara Berglund and Brad Rosenstein from the Presidio Trust to hear about the Presidio military band's history. And Peter Robinson will muse on the month of November. Also, some tickets to give away, so do stay tuned to Open Air. Thanks. The Golden Gate Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, led by its music director Urs Lionheart Steiner, presents Sent Down Youth, an Intercultural Exchange. November 5th, admission Dolores Basilica here in San Francisco, and Sunday the 6th in Berkeley. It commemorates the 50th anniversary of China's Sent Down Youth movement, the program which will showcase a rare performance of Ask the Sky and the Earth, a classical oratorio cantata for orchestra, chorus, and solo voices by Chinese composer Tony Fok and librettist Wai Su, that reflects upon one of the largest cultural experiments in human history. I'm pleased to welcome music director Urs Lionheart Steiner and Chinese soprano soloist E. Triplett to the studio. Urs is also a highly regarded conductor, guitarist, educator, and composer. He's founder of the San Francisco Sinfonietta back in 1994, which is now known as the Golden Gate Symphony and Chorus. He's a Swiss native, and conducted training not only includes our own San Francisco Conservatory of Music, but the likes of Herbert von Karajan, Andre Previn, Eric Leinsdorf, and Leonard Bernstein. Here in San Francisco, he is the music director of the Community Music Center Orchestra, as well as the Ada Clevenger School Show Choir. Urs, a pleasure to finally welcome you to Open Air.
Thank you so much. I was glad to be here.
He's joined by E. Triplett, who was born in Shanghai. She's always had a passion for music and a love for mathematics. During the Chinese Cultural Revolution, she was sent to the countryside to work in the fields, which is the basis for this work we're going to talk about primarily. In 1982, she came to the United States to complete her master's degree at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and later to pursue her interest in both math and science, she applied to and was admitted to the College of Engineering at UC Berkeley, where she graduated with a degree in civil engineering. E, a fascinating combination of interests. We're happy to have you on the air as well.
Thank you for having me here.
So we have to talk about primarily Ask the Earth, Ask the Sky and Earth, this large oratorio. Urs, how did you first come across this work?
I came across this work about a year and a half ago when I did Beethoven 9th Symphony, and I got an invitation of a Chinese chorus in the East Bay in Pleasanton who wanted to participate in the 9th Symphony with me, through a member of my orchestra. And at my first rehearsal, when I decided to invite them to sing with us in Pleasanton, I met this young woman named Eve Xiang, who was a Sent Down Youth and turned me on to the music. I gave her a ride home, and she was very excitedly telling me, "You have to check this out. This is great. This is it's fantastic," and so on and so forth. So I listened to it. I ended up going to Frankfurt, Germany, where it was performed by Chinese chorus from around the world, as well as the a local orchestra, the university orchestra, and it was at the Süddeutsche Rundfunk, which is well known as a great radio station over in Germany. Anyway, it turned me on. I thought it was really fascinating to be able to do a work which the people who have experienced what you're singing about are with you. And they're still around, and it emotionally works fantastic, because rarely you have the opportunity to work on something which is so directly. People can tell you the stories, they're singing in it, soloists who have done it have the experience, and so on and so forth. So we decided the Golden Gate Symphony is the first Western organization to actually take it on. It's been performed around the world 11 times, including Shanghai, Carnegie Hall, and Australia, and so on and so forth, but never as a cross-cultural project.
Mm-hmm. E. Triplett, you have a very personal connection to this work, having been a part of that whole sent-down youth movement. Tell me, take us back to that time, if you would, Mao Zedong and the Cultural Revolution, how it affected you and how it affected your family.
In the 1966 all the way to 1976, during that period of time, mainly the young people get to send to countryside due to two main reasons. One is a political reason, that is Mao Zedong, who wants to get rid of some of the main government officials that he does not agree with his politics and his direction of the guidance of the country. And in order to get rid of those people holding important position in the country, they need to start from the down, make the country entirely go upside down. So starting with the young people, become the Red Guards, then eventually get to the upper level of the central government to have the country's politics completely changed and to go to his direction. That's one. Number two is the economic reasons. The cities need to feed so many people. In order to get the economy going, disperse some of the young people to the countryside so we can feed everybody. So in 1967 or so, the Cultural Revolution is still in the beginning stage. Mao had command to the young people. Every 1966 to 1968, that group, majority, about 90% of the young people get sent down to far away from the cities.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was too young to go then, but by 1974, 75, it's time for us to go. So I went as well and went to the countryside. The condition is so primitive that we had to grow up in a week to survive. Just describe the settings we live in. The windows all covered with the tar paper. So the window has a hole in the tar paper. You peel down, then you have the lights come in. Otherwise, it's completely dark. And we did not have electricity. And the inside room has just dirt floor. So when it's rain, we have to have rain boots inside.
Wow. It's extraordinary that this happened on such a massive scale. And I'm just trying to understand how it was presented to you. Was it presented to you that you were going to, you know, a cultural revolution, you're going to be bringing new life to Chinese culture, or did you already know at that point that you were just basically being sent to the country? It seems like a tremendous propaganda campaign within the regime that was making this a wonderful thing that was going to happen to you.
In the beginning, it's like brainwashed to go. By the time we need to go, we already know it's going to be very difficult. And they said the people in the city who are spoiled and do not know how life should be and how you're going to be able to handle the future revolution life. So we're going to send you down to the countryside to be re-educated by the farmers, by the working class. Mm. So, yeah, that's how we got sent down to work in the harsh field without any preparation to know how. So when you jump into a setting like that, we have to learn really, really quickly to be able to even live.
Mm. And how long were you in as a part of that whole situation?
I was there about 3 years.
3 years. And from there, did you come to the United States, or was there a period where you went back to your family? Or?
In 1976, Mao Zedong died. I remember very clearly he died on September 9th. That's the day the entire country mourned for him. But very soon, actually less than 6 months, the school, the universities in the cities reopened.
Mm-hmm.
It's under the new leader, Deng Xiaoping. Then there's a rumor in spring already, 1977 spring time. They said that there will be, if you pass the examination, then you will be able to re-enter the university. In spring of 77, my parents sent down the books for me to review. In the beginning, I thought that was ridiculous, and there's no hope here. But my parents said, you always wanted to go to school, and now is your chance to study.
Mm.
So during daytime, we still do the farming work. In the evening, I have a big flashlight to study. In the fall of that year, we had examinations, and it was a 3-day examination in a local high school. And I still remember the table only had 3 legs.
Extraordinary.
And we just got like a few those plain dough steamed for lunch, and that was our exam day food. Then under the tremendous pressure, we did not even have appetite for any food. Yeah, but the do well, try to leave the countryside. That was our goal.
Mm, amazing. Talking with E. Triplett, whose extraordinary story of her life in China during and after the Cultural Revolution is partially accounted for in the work Ask the Sky and the Earth, being presented by the Golden Gate Symphony and Chorus this weekend. Talking also with Landhart Steiner, the music director of the orchestra. Urs, let's get down to what's in Ask the Sky and the Earth. How did it get the title, first of all?
I think it's just referring to the whole story of having to go to the countryside and dealing with the earth. And the sky is sort of the hope, in my opinion. It represents, you look up, you hope that this is going to go by at some point. And it looks like Tony Falk, who actually was down at the Sandtown News for 10 years, and Wei Su also, both of them, had the really intense experiences. And so I think when Tony wrote the music and talked to Wei Su to do the lyrics, I think they really wanted to tell the story of that period of time. And there is 8 movements in the piece, and it takes you through different moments. It opens up with leaving the cities. Then it talks about having to work in the fields and what you have to accomplish, like making rubber for the railroads and for. Then it talks about love, number 5, which Yi is actually, it's just a letter home. Well, not number 3. There's a love affair in number 4,
right.
And then or thinking about it anyway, and so it's a duet there. And then number 5 is about a letter home from a personal perspective,
which is one of the movements that E. Triplett sings. E, could you tell us a little bit about that letter home, and then we're going to hear it, actually you singing it.
Actually, letter to home, it was the support. It's only a way that we can express ourselves and try to get some support from home. And in this song, this young girl writes a letter to tell her mother that in the countryside there is local support and help of the local farmers and give some type of care. But our as a young person, we have our dream for our future life pretty much dies here. We will have our future is if someone wants to be a musician, wants to be a writer, wants to be an artist, want to be engineers, you cannot. You stay here.
Here's E. Triplett singing a portion of Ask the Sky and the Earth by Tony Falk, and then more with Urs Leinhardt Steiner and E. Soprano E. Triplett from Ask the Sky and the Earth, a movement called A Letter Home. It's by composer Tony Falk with Wai Zhu as lyricist and presented as part of the Golden Gate Symphony Chorus and Orchestra's concerts this weekend, Saturday at Mission Dolores Basilica here in San Francisco and Sunday in Berkeley. Also on the program, Beethoven's Sixth Symphony and Remembering for Atonement, a world premiere by Michael Kimball. Beautiful singing, Eva.
Thank you.
Urs, we need to talk ever so briefly about the rest of the program. Remembering for Atonement is written by Michael Kimball, which will have its premiere. Michael is also a clarinetist with your ensemble.
Correct, yes. And he's been composing for us for about 15 years. It's his 11th work we commissioned from him. The point was I wanted to have sort of a thought about what Michael is thinking about the Ask the Sky and the Earth. So it's in reference to that. And the atonement part is, I think he sees this work more of as atoning the, you know, all these different places in the world who had the same issues one way or another. And his family had experiences in Europe earlier, you know, which are very, you know, the Nazi time and all that. So I think he took sort of the Ask the Sky concept and made it more international, so to speak. So it's a short piece. It's about 7 minutes long, but it's also for chorus and orchestra.
I'm beginning to also see the connection now with the Pastoral Symphony,
right,
from the sent down youth to the countryside. And
correct. So it made immediate sense to for me personally, what you're going to put in there. And I think the Beethoven 6 is fantastic that way.
Well, we have five pairs of complimentary tickets, which we're offering to callers who reach us here at 415-841-4134. You can go to either the Mission Dolores Basilica concert on Saturday evening at 7:30 or the Sunday performance in Berkeley. 415-841-4134. E. Triplett, thank you so much for coming in, and we wish you a wonderful performance and continued learning more about your other interests as well as music. And Urs, I'd like you to just explain a little bit about the cut we're going out on, We're Back, also from Ask the Sky and the Earth.
We're Back is basically the concept that we are now ready to go back home. We can go back home. We can have a life. We can now build again, so to speak.
Urs Lionheart Steiner and Chinese soprano soloist E. Triplett, also featured for that Ask the Sky and the Earth, will be Shine Zhao, tenor, and Alex Ip, bass baritone. Program also includes Michael Kimball's Remembering for Atonement and Beethoven's Symphony No. 6. Here's another excerpt from Ask the Sky and Earth. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're back, and we are indeed back. That's from Ask the Sky and the Earth, a classical oratorio cantata for orchestra, chorus, and solo voices by Tony Falk, being performed by the Golden Gate Symphony. Information at goldengatesymphony.org for those performances on Saturday and Sunday. There will be supertitle translation, by the way, of the Chinese as they sing. That program also includes the Sixth Symphony in Beethoven and a work by Mr. Kimball, Michael Kimball, Remembering for Atonement. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air here on KALW San Francisco. More tickets to give away before the hour is out. We'll have some tickets for the Peninsula Symphony, which features pianist Conrad Tau performing the Schumann Piano Concerto, Elgar's Enigma Variations, and Carolyn Bremer's work, First Light, which we'll hear a portion of, and we'll talk with Conrad, Mitch, and Carolyn before the hour is out. Well, Barbara Berglund, historian, and Brad Rosenstein, program producer from the Presidio Trust, are here to talk about the history of the Presidio military bands and their upcoming November 10th presentation. For nearly 140 years, the Presidio's multiple army bands have played an essential role, not just at the military post, but in the cultural life of the Bay Area. They're here to talk about this multimedia presentation. Barbara and Brad, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much,
Thank
David.
You.
Well, what got your interest initially in the Presidio bands? Barbara?
As a Presidio Trust Heritage Program staff, we all take turns at the front desk of the Officers Club welcoming the public to the historic building. And one day I was there, and someone who had been an alumni of the 6th Army Band came up and started telling me about his enthusiasm for his experience. And at the same time, I had known that our librarian, John Bertland, who's also been integral to this project, had been digging around, unearthing some interesting stuff. So between the two, hearing about alumni, many of whom were still playing, and these interesting stories that were percolating up from some research, we knew we had something. We talked to Brad and said, I think we have a program in the making.
Nice. Where did you get your historian background?
Well, I guess started at San Francisco State in their master's degree program, and then went on to the University of Michigan for a PhD.
Neat.
Yeah.
And Brad, how did this program come together then? I mean, we obviously have a rich source material.
Well, we did. And John started uncovering all these gems from the archives, and a lot of this was research that nobody had done into the history of these bands. But what caught us immediately was that how important the bands were, not just to the life of the base, mm-hmm. which is what you would expect, but how tremendously important, from the very beginning, back to 1858, they had been in the life of the city, that the bands were always playing on social events, civic occasions, out in the life of San Francisco and the Bay Area. And this became a huge part of what their identity was, and connecting the base with the town was always a part of that history. And that's what was so intriguing to us, because we really hadn't anticipated that connection.
Well, how did the role of the bands change over time? I mean, imagine they started off with just
military procedures. Well, you know, what we got interested in was why there were bands to begin with.
Right.
And Barbara started delving into even some of the ancient history.
Right. And neither of us are military history specialists or military band specialists. So to learn that military music was essential for military purposes, not amusement, that it was to signal troops in combat, to move large bodies of people around, to signal the rituals of the day, to
establish the rhythm of an army marching.
Exactly.
And that they were playing, you know, right at the forefront, right on the battlefield. And this was true all the way back to the Babylonians and the Assyrians up until the 19th century.
Yeah.
And we forget that. We think of these bands as being decorative. We think of them marching in parades and kind of being army PR, mm-hmm. recruitment tools.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't think of the fact that for a long part of the military history, they were an essential part of life on the battlefield.
Wow.
As well as in training. Mm-hmm.
Until technology made them obsolete in that way, you know, and they continued for these PR, recruitment, support, and morale roles.
Exactly.
Well, sadly, what I've also learned is that even in contemporary, with the training that trumpeters can get now, a lot of times they just send a trumpeter with a recorded taps in
right.
your trumpet instead
right.
of having someone play it live. So, but it's still an important part of it. Yeah.
And that personal connection was a very important part of this music, too. Something we've been trying to get our heads back into is how enormously popular this music was. There was no recorded music. Everybody who experienced music was experiencing it live.
Right.
And
right.
so the effect of having a band and going out to see them, and not just at a military or a parade, but at seaside resorts,
mm-hmm.
Military music was tremendously popular throughout the 19th and into the early 20th century.
Sure.
John Philip Sousa caused that whole evolution to happen at that time. And, you know, we could probably play a track, you know, that you have here, because all of this stuff, there's almost no military band music for the last 150 years that wasn't played by these bands at the Presidio.
Mm, indeed. So your website shows a fascinating 1954 incarnation of the Presidio bands with a beaming trumpeter, Herb Alpert.
Yeah.
Right smack dab in the middle. Now, who were some of the other more notable figures
well,
in the band's history?
This was amazing because we really had not anticipated this. But, you know, the San Francisco jazz scene in the 50s is known as one of the hallmarks of that era. There were so many great people who came out of the clubs in the Fillmore. Part of that came directly from the Presidio bands, and it started even during World War II. Dave Brubeck wasn't stationed here, but he was in an army band in L.A. He came up to visit a friend of his who was in the Presidio bands, Dave Van Crete, who introduced him to Paul Desmond, who became one of the legendary alto sax players of all time. Dave Van Crete and Desmond were at the forefront of Dave Brubeck's octet when it was first formed, and were, you know, they were cross-pollinating with life at the Presidio. They were spending time in the jazz clubs in the Fillmore. But also this other influence we hadn't anticipated was Mills College, because so many of these guys came back on the GI Bill after the war and were training with Darius Milhaud under this very European classical tradition at Mills College. Most of these guys were not yet listening to Charlie Parker.
Right.
They were listening to Mozart. Right.
Yeah,
and you can hear
enough.
That in a lot of this music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The early recordings.
Also, we've also been speculating, too, how much the military rhythms had an effect on a lot of their early jazz take, because so much of what was revolutionary in people like Brubeck was changing the time signature, which was what was so essential to being part of a military band.
Interesting. Barbara, I imagine that, you know, as opposed to some other organizations that have photos of past bands, you probably got a lot of names because of the military precision. Probably well documented who was in the band, so that's probably helpful to you. But were there any kind of rabbit holes you had to go down to dig up some names?
Well, it's a little less documented than you might suspect. A lot of the records of personnel at the Presidio aren't in the park archives that we have, and so we've had to do kind of some piecing together and digging of who was in the bands over time, and the bands changed constantly. You know, with every new group of military who came in, there were bands with them. So the names, the 6th Army Band was with the Presidio from 1949 on, but that was a very kind of unique situation in that 20th century history. So before that, you have the names of the bands changing, turning over, being there for short periods of time, and then leaving.
Sometimes they're simultaneously,
right.
Multiple bands.
Yeah, that we had one discovery that we made was of a WAC band, Women's Army Corps, who played to lift the morale of soldiers during World War II, which was really a great find, and the images are fantastic. We don't have any live recordings, but and a Buffalo Soldier band of African-American soldiers as well, before desegregation.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
The Presidio was at such a forefront, particularly during World War II. It was important not only as a point of disembarkation for the whole Pacific Theater, but it was also at Letterman Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And it was where so many of the wounded were coming back and then also going on to Mare Island. So there was so much traffic of veterans going back and forth, both being shipped out and coming back. And the bands played a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
They would play these people off when they were going onto the troop ships, and they would welcome them back when they were coming home, wounded or not.
That's and that was true in the Civil War, in the Spanish-American War, in the Philippine-American War, all the way through.
Yeah.
That's historian Barbara Berglund talking with program producer from the Presidio Trust, Brad Rosenstein. Brad, so this is being billed as a multimedia presentation of sorts. What's going to happen on November 2nd, November 10th?
Well, one of the things we were thrilled
about. The day before Veterans Day.
It is, and programmed for that reason. And one of the things we, of course, wanted to have were military musicians, the band. And we were actually able to find out there's an Army Reserve unit in Sacramento that was they're going to be sending 5 of their core members to participate. They're going to be supplemented with 3 veterans of the actual Presidio band, of the 6th Army band. So we'll have a total of 8 musicians performing live. And they have been the most wonderful collaborators, because we went to them looking for, because we're telling the whole history very quickly of this 140 years. And they have dug into their library, they've dug into their archives, and they're coming up. We're going to have music that's typical of all these periods that we're talking about. perform live, as well as imagery and some video.
A few choice quotes from oral histories that were done of some of the luminaries, Herb Albert, Chet Baker.
Right. It'll be quite a mix of information.
Nice. It's going to be Thursday, November 10th at 6 p.m. at the Presidio Officers Club, which is on 50 Moraga Avenue in the Presidio. Where can we go for more information for people that are interested?
Our website, which is presidio.gov, and go to the events section for the Officers Club.
Great. We're going to go out with some music, Bravura.
And this was a piece that we know was played in 1995 when the base was finally closed and the whole nearly 140-year history of the bands ended. We know this was one of the pieces they played on that last day as they marched out of the gates.
Barbara, Brad, thanks for coming in.
Thank you
so much.
Sure. Open Air here on Local Public Radio. Some marching music for you for your visit to the Presidio this pre-Veterans Day on the 10th. Presidio.gov for more information on that concert about the grand history of the Presidio bands. David LaTulipe here with a very musical edition of Open Air. Speaking of which, we'll have some more tickets to give away, this time to the Peninsula Symphony, which presents Konrad Tau performing Schumann's Piano Concerto in A Minor, Opus 54, Elgar Enigma Variations, and Carolyn Bremer's Early Light. All three of whom, well, not Schumann and not Elgar. Let me think about that for a second.
I'm old, but not that old.
Let me rephrase that introduction. Three of the key players of this concert are with me here, including the music director and conductor of the orchestra, Mitchell Sardou-Klein, pianist Konrad Tau, and Carolyn Bremer. Maestro Klein has brought extraordinary musicality and a tremendous sense of community to the Peninsula Symphony for some 31 years, and he's frequently engaged to guest conduct all over the world. He's also founder and music director of the Peninsula Youth Orchestra, and since 1984 has been director of the Irving M. Klein International String Competition, named for his father, which has become one of the most prominent competitions in the world and launched numerous major international concert careers. Maestro has conducted many significant world, American, and West Coast premieres, has appeared frequently on national and international radio and television broadcasts, including KLW on more than one occasion. Always a pleasure to welcome you back.
Always great to see you, David.
And today with an entourage.
And a glorious one. We're really thrilled to have this fabulous representation on our concert.
Indeed. Let me just mention a couple things about Conrad. Our concert features another composer, one who puts on his other professional hat as extremely well-acclaimed concert pianist. Earlier this year, he was part of the Artist's Studio at the Park Avenue Armory in New York. And among his many honors and distinctions, in 2011, he was named a Presidential Scholar in the Arts and has had 8 consecutive ASCAP Morton Gould Young Composer Awards. Wow. This season began for Conrad somewhat up in the air, literally, as he performed the world premiere of David Lang's new opera, The Loser, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music with baritone Rod Guilfrey, suspended on a platform above the audience. Well, we couldn't talk Maestro Klein into doing that for the Schumann Piano Concerto, but nonetheless, we're pleased to at least have him in front, on solid ground in front of our orchestra. Welcome, Conrad.
Thank you very much.
And full disclosure, I'm a member of this said orchestra, so I've got a bit of a bias, and I'm encouraging people to come here, not only your wonderful playing, but to discover the wonderful music of Carolyn Bremer. Her music has been heard at Carnegie Hall and around the world. Her musical training comes courtesy of the Eastman School and the UC Santa Barbara. She was chair of the composition department late last century, I believe, and currently teaches at the Bob Cole Conservatory of Music at Cal State Long Beach. Welcome to you, Carolyn.
Thank you very much.
Your training comes through being an orchestral bassist. When did you switch gears to more composition?
I switched gears rather late. I was a bass major through my junior year in undergrad in college, and it really didn't, I didn't officially have my first lesson until I entered graduate school as a composer at Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. So, it was pretty late.
And tell us about the basis of Early Light. I'm going to find it on YouTube while you speak. So,
Early Light isn't originally for orchestra, and it is my much preferred version. I wrote it for a outdoor concert when I was teaching at the University of Oklahoma that was going to have a dance component for some strange reason. And for those who know the Midwest, it's a summer concert. Sometimes, even late at night, it can still be about 100 degrees out. So I remember sitting in the audience sweating a lot for not the typical reason a composer would sweat a lot. And when it was first performed, the clarinet player in the group said, you know, you ought to arrange that for band. And that version has become my so-called one-hit wonder. It's been played maybe 10,000 times for band.
It's really a part of the standard repertoire for both bands and wind ensembles now.
Yeah, it really is. And the orchestra version gets performed rarely, so it's a real treat to be up here for this.
And it's a perfect fit for this concert because if you're a Cubs fan, you will instantly celebrate the fact that it starts, it kind of ends with the crack of a baseball bat after having heard little bits and snippets that Ives would recognize as being the national anthem. And so it couldn't be more timely and more festive for opening our season.
What I'm really enjoying about playing the piece, not only you gave me a couple of nice piccolo licks, which we'll talk about, but the way you incorporate not just blatant quotes of the Star Spangled Banner of these other tunes, but they're really subtle and they're varied with a kind of a nice little twist.
Yeah, and there are some other tunes hidden in there. You'll hear Row, Row Your Boat in the basses at one point.
I did not hear that.
Yes.
I'm going to have to listen for that.
Right. Sometimes the basses miss it, too, to tell you the truth. I've always had that sort of quote libé adding other little tunes in propensity in my music.
Well, I have to ask you, you gave me, the piccolo player, a nice little colonial tune that I recognized from a fife and drum. What was that tune?
You know, that one, and I have a terrible time remembering the name of it, so I actually opened my score and it was written in there. But that was yesterday, and I still no longer remember.
You have the score with you, Mitch?
I don't, unfortunately. Well, but it does have that festive Ives quality, you know, in a 21st century way. But it's just a fun piece.
Well, let's have a listen to it. This is Early Light, the band version. We'll hear the U.S. Air Force Heritage of America band perform Carolyn Bremer's Early Light. Then more with Carolyn Maestro Klein and Conrad Tau. With that little piccolo excerpt, I will unbiasedly cut back to my guests. That's from Early Light by Carolyn Bremer, performed this weekend by the Peninsula Symphony, Friday at the San Mateo Performing Arts Center, Saturday at the Flint Center in Cupertino. We do have tickets for this performance, 5 pairs of complimentary tickets for either the San Mateo performance or the Cupertino performance, available to those that call 415-841-4134. Wonderful writing, Carolyn. I'm really enjoying your piece.
Thank you very much.
That will be conducted, by the way, by our new guest assistant conductor, Chad Goodman, who's also a fine trumpeter and founder and artistic director of Elevate Ensemble, which we've also featured here on Open Air. Mitchell Sardou Klein, I should say, for clarity's sake. Wonderful program you put together, including one of your favorite works, I understand, Elgar's Enigma Variations.
It's an amazing piece of music and an interesting compositional experience. It comes out of improvisation, which is not the normal genesis of a work in the Romantic period. He was sitting at the piano after visiting with some friends and talking to his wife about how a particular musical fragment would have sounded if this particular friend had written it, if this particular friend had played it. And that thread, that idea of connecting musical bits and musical personalities to a theme in Variations was born, as it were. And I think it's his greatest orchestral work. I think it's kind of generally acknowledged as such. It's a phenomenal and very personal piece of music. It shares in that sense that intimacy and that personal connection with the Schumann Piano Concerto, which is all about Robert and Clara Schumann and their connection and Robert's wish to enshrine that in a great piece of music. But in this case, Elgar created a double enigma, which is another fun puzzle aspect of this, which gives it extra layers of meaning, in two ways. Number one was not entirely resolved enigma about where the theme comes from. It probably is the second theme in the slow movement of the Prague Symphony of Mozart, which was played on the first program when it was, and lots of stories behind that. But there will not be an authoritative answer to that because he went to his grave for many years, actually, holding on to that secret.
Remains an enigma, shall we say.
It does, mm-hmm. And you can discover it yourself at every performance and see what you think about it.
And we will actually have some help on that front for audience members.
We will, because each one of these 14 variations is a very intimate and personal and sometimes funny and sometimes very touching reflection on the relationship between Elgar and these 14 people, one of whom is him, so that gets it down to 13, and one of whom is his wife, and one of whom is the dog of the person who's involved, and that's a pretty funny one. It's really important for the audience to know who these people are, what there was in that connection between Elgar and that particular individual that's being encapsulated here. And so we'll have photographs of each one of those individuals. You couldn't have done that with music of Beethoven or Brahms. And then a little bit of a thumbnail of what's going on in that variation. And when I've done this in the past in various places with super titles and photographs, people laugh in the right places. Mm-hmm. And they sigh in the right places. It just makes a much richer, more fun, and more multi-layered experience.
Apparently it kind of annoyed the critics at first when it came out, because it was like they were trying to figure out the puzzle and they had no clue as to what was going on. A little bit too much play involved, too much puzzling involved.
Yeah, but and now that we've sort of gotten over...
And it works as a standalone piece as well. You don't necessarily...
Oh, God, yes. Amazing. It's some of the most gorgeous music he ever wrote. Some of the most profound music. The Nimrod Variations is still revered by almost anybody in classical music as one of the most insightful, most profound statements of personal reflection that anybody ever wrote.
Mitchell Sardou Klein talking about the Peninsula Symphony's concerts this weekend, Friday at the San Mateo Performing Arts Center, Saturday at the Flint Center in Cupertino. We do have tickets available for listeners who call 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. Pleased to be presenting Carolyn Bremer's Early Light, as well as the Schumann Piano Concerto, which brings us to Konrad Dau. Konrad, you got some great press, before we talk about the Schumann, you got some great press and reviews for the inaugural Unplay Festival back in 2013.
Exactly, 2013.
Yeah, in Brooklyn. What made that event so unique?
Well, in addition to the festival itself, it remains unique because I haven't done it since. but no, the Unplay Festival in 2013, I wanted to basically structure a festival around, you know, three different programming concepts. So it was three different things I was very, very interested in at the time. One was just this general philosophical inquiry that electroacoustic music often presents and trying to explore different performers' approaches to answering the many questions posed by electroacoustic performance. One program called Replay or Rep Play, which was about, you know, wondering what a contemporary canon might, what that might mean. And then one was a program about social activism and contemporary music and how these two worlds have often been intertwined in interesting ways.
So perhaps this will happen again at some point.
Yes, I am hoping to. I have a new space in mind, and it's uptown instead of in Brooklyn. And so, yeah, hopefully.
And what's happening for you after these performances with the Peninsula?
I am towards the end of about 12 straight weeks of work, which began with the David Lang opera that you mentioned earlier. I have a performance in Rome next week of Gershwin's Concerto in F, and then the week after that, I'm in Asheville, North Carolina, performing Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue.
Oh, you poor guy.
I know. I know. It's such a difficult life.
And you're working in composing with all of this.
I am. I have I'm writing a lot of orchestral music, actually, and I have a piano concerto that's being performed by the Atlantic Classical Orchestra in March. I'm writing an orchestral work for the Hong Kong Philharmonic, which Jaap van Zweden will be conducting in April. And then I've got, you know, I'm hoping to at least get started on workshopping an experimental opera next May. So there's always a lot of different things. I have my fingers in different pies all the time.
And the Schumann Piano Concerto that we're performing with you this coming weekend, a big part of your repertoire?
It's one that I've done for several years now, and it's a piece that I've struggled with in the past, and only recently, I think, started feeling like I understood on an emotional level. It took me some time to realize that this was really just a music about love, and it took me some time to figure out what that meant for me performatively. I think it might just be a matter of getting older, which is a comment that my younger self would have hated.
Now, just for our audience's sake, how old are you, Connor?
Oh, yes. I'm 22. Thank you for not mentioning it. It's so nice to not have that be part of the narrative.
So much older and wiser than when you first
right,
started.
Exactly. I'm much more wise to the tricks of love, I suppose. I don't know. Regardless, it's an extremely heartfelt and delicate and personal piece, as Schumann tends to be. And it's really quite incredible.
Conrad Dau will be performing the Schumann Piano Concerto in A minor, Opus 54, is a concert that also includes Elgar Enigma Variations and Carolyn Bremer's Early Light. Information for this concert at peninsulasymphony.org. We still do have tickets available for listeners who call 415-841-4134 for either Friday's San Mateo Performing Arts Center performance or Saturdays at the Flint Center in Cupertino. And more information about Carolyn Bremer and her wonderful compositions and work, which also includes a lot of multimedia work and some Tibetan sound bowls, I understand.
Tibetan singing bowls.
Singing bowls at carolynbremer.com. That's BREMER.com. Carolyn, Conrad, Maestro Klein, I look forward to this performance.
We do too. It's going to be most exciting.
With the final strains of the first movement of the Schumann Piano Concerto, this by Murray Pariah, I bid you adieu for this week's edition of Open Air, a reminder that our broadcasts are archived at kalw.org. Thanks to Neil Swinkels for producing the show, and if you got a segment idea, do email me, david@kalw.org.